All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 661 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to call this the Sprinting Through Genetics. Sprinting Through Genetics. We know that genetics is something that pops up on the USMLE exams, right? A lot on step one, but definitely on step two and step three as well. So I want to kind of sprint through the key things you need to know for most of the high-yield genetic diseases. So this would be one of those things where you're like, I just want a quick and dirty review of genetics for step two and step three. This will be a very good primer for that kind of situation. So first thing, what if they give you a question about a child, right? And they tell you that this child is like 15 years old and you're told that he has a history of recurring respiratory infections. And then you're told that, for the last 2 days, he has been having high fevers. Has been having shortness of breath, and then they tell you that you listen to the lungs and you hear decreased breath sounds on the right side, and then they tell you that a sputum sample is obtained, and then they'll ask you like which of the following is the most likely finding with a gram stain of a sputum sample specimen, right? And you know, they will tell you something about like a history of malabsorption or whatever, and I'd really hope you're saying that, hey, I'm gonna find like gram positive cocci, right? So this person has cystic fibrosis, right? So remember, cystic fibrosis arises from a CFTR mutation. It's on chromosome 7, is autosomal recessive, right? And as many of us know, I'm going to explain the findings for this question. The delta F508 deletion is the classic mutation, right? Basically, the pathophase there is that you have this misfolded protein, right? And it basically gets degraded before it even reaches the membrane of the cell, right? And then if that happens, chloride bicarb is not going to be transported well. Many people just memorize like the chloride transporter issue with the CFTR transporter. But one thing people don't realize is that bicarb is also not transported well. That's actually kind of important to know for your exams, right? So these people, they have like very thick sputum, very thick secretions. So that causes them to have recurrent infections with Staph aureus, for example. Remember, Staph aureus is the most common cause of pneumonia in CF patients that are less than 18 years, less than 20. Once you get past age 20, it's going to be Pseudomonas, right? So if it was a lobar pneumonia and they were asking for the expected sputum sample results for a person over 20, they want to be thinking along the lines of a gram negatives, right? That's Pseudomonas. But here, the person is under 20 that I described in the vignette. So it's going to be a gram positive cocci, which is how Staph aureus is, right? And remember, people that have cystic fibrosis, many times they'll have like diarrhea, right? From fat malabsorption, right? Because they have a pancreatic insufficiency, lipase is not being released. So because lipase is not being released, they're not able to emulsify fat and digest fat, right? So they have like a fat malabsorption, right? And then remember, they can also have like a meconium ileus, right? As neonates, you notice that, wow, they've lived for more than 48 hours and they've not pooped. So how do we diagnose this? Remember, again, we diagnose this with a sweat chloride test. It's going to be elevated, right? And you're going to notice that the newborn screen, part of the newborn screen, actually, that we screen, the things we screen for, we check that serum immunoreactive trypsinogen, right? So again, you see a child, in addition to the vignettes I've presented, but you see a child that is, or not even a child, it can be a male that is infertile, and then they tell you that, oh, that there's a bilateral absence of the vas deferens on diagnostic testing. Think of the CFTR, mutation, right? Think of cystic fibrosis. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is from an African country and you're told that, he has a history of that he was adopted and his birth history was unknown. And you're told that he has a history of chronic fatigue. And then now he presents with very severe pain in his extremities. And then you're also given like some labs and you notice that his hemoglobin is 8.2 and his MCV is 85. So it's a normocytic anemia. And then you're also told that, over the last year, he has had two episodes of pneumococcal pneumonia that have required antibiotic therapy. Well, if you see something like this, I'd hope you're thinking of a person having sickle cell disease, right? Remember, sickle cell disease, just like cystic fibrosis, is autosomal recessive, right? Remember, cystic fibrosis was a chromosome 7 problem. Sickle cell disease is a chromosome 11 problem, right? Basically, it's a single point mutation, right? Glutamic acid is replaced by valine at position 6, right? Of the beta globin chain. And the thing is, in hypoxic environments, this hemoglobin S that is formed, right? Deoxygenated hemoglobin S, it likes to form polymers. And the thing is, those polymers are the things that then cause the red blood cell to sickle. That's what causes the red blood cell to sickle, right? And then those things are also very adept at occluding vessels. So you're going to have like vaso-occlusive crises. You're going to have extravascular hemolysis, intravascular hemolysis, right? And remember, over time, these people are going to auto-infarct their spleens. And as the spleen gets auto-infarcted, right, they're going to start struggling with encapsulated organisms. Remember, strep pneumo is an encapsulated organism. So these people, they tend to have very serious infections with encapsulated bugs, right? So like strep pneumo, H. influenza, Neisseria meningitidis, and things like that, right? And then remember, if they give you a question about a person that has sickle cell disease and the person has hip pain, what should you be thinking about? Well, I'd really hope that you're thinking about some kind of osteonecrosis, right? Some kind of avascular necrosis of the femoral head, right? Or if they describe a person that has sickle cell disease and they have like very severe chest pain and all those things, like very severe chest pain, and they tell you that chest radiography shows like pulmonary infiltrates, I'd hope you're thinking about acute chest syndrome, right? Remember, typically for those, you're going to do some kind of plasma exchange, right? You're going to do some kind of a plasma exchange, right? And they can have all these vaso-occlusive crises. Remember, give those people opioids for those vaso-occlusive crises, right? Now, one thing you just want to keep in mind with this African association that I mentioned at the beginning is that people that are heterozygotes, right? People that have sickle cell trait, right? They tend to actually get protection from Plasmodium falciparum and malaria, right? It's just one of those strange associations to know for your exams. And if you ever see hematuria in a person that has sickle cell disease, the thing you absolutely want to think about is renal papillary necrosis, right? And then remember, osteomyelitis in sickle cell disease is going to be caused by salmonella, right? All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a child and you're told that this child, you know, has a history of just chronic weakness chronic muscle weakness, and then you're told that over the last, you know, past year, he has been having progressively worsening shortness of breath. And they tell you that when you listen to his lungs, you can hear crackles, right? You can hear crackles. And they tell you that imaging shows echocardiography shows like biventricular dilation, right? And then we're told that, again, he has a lot of proximal muscle weakness. And you're told that he has very stoutly defined lower extremities. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? I'd hope you're saying, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like DMD, like Duchenne muscular dystrophy, right? Remember, this is an X-linked recessive disorder. So it's highly likely to show up in males on your exams. Right? Remember, what's the pathophys, right? It's a frame shift deletion. Guys, as you see me emphasize the specific pathophysiology behind some of these genetic syndromes, make sure you know them for your exams, right? So it's a frame shift deletion, right? And that basically causes you to have like complete absence of dystrophin. You want to be able to compare this with Becker's muscular dystrophy, where it's more of an in-frame mutation, right? So you form dystrophin that has partial function in Becker's. You form no dystrophin whatsoever in Duchenne's, right? And generally, again, we're going to see it in boys. It's going to, they're going to start having symptoms very early in life. They'll have a lot of proximal weakness, which is indicative of a myopathy, right? Remember, whenever you see proximal muscle weakness, you think of a myopathy, and they're going to have Gower sign, right? You're going to basically use your arms to walk up the body for you to stand, you know, from like a seated position or from being on the ground, right? And the thing is, you know, what's the mechanism behind those stout limbs that I described in the vignette that I gave? Well, it's this thing known as a calf pseudo hypertrophy, right? So the thing is, instead of muscle, like the muscles, their muscles can get replaced with fibrofatty tissue, like a lot of fibrous tissue, a lot of fatty tissue, right? And many times you're going to notice in the question stem that these people are going to have a very high creatine kinase. Their CK is going to be elevated, right? Now, why did I talk about the crackles and whatnot? Well, this person has dilated cardiomyopathy. Remember, dilated cardiomyopathy is actually the most common cause of death in these people. In fact, our friends at the MBMEs can give you a question about a person that has Duchenne muscular dystrophy and ask which of the following screening tests should be conducted at this time. Pick the answer choice that talks about echocardiography, because you want to screen them for the dilated cardiomyopathy that is characteristic of that disease, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient, right? And they tell you that this patient has been seeing a lot of inappropriate things in recent times. He's a 37-year-old male. And then they ask, you know, he has been saying, you know, just very strange things. He has been having unusual, they tell you that his wife brought him to the physician because he has been having like unusual movements of his extremities. And, you know, that he has been very depressed, right? He has been very depressed. He has become very forgetful. If you see something like this, I'd hope you're thinking about Huntington's, right? The thing is, our friends at the MBMEs, they recognize that it's super easy for many people to recognize Huntington's. So sometimes they like to ask surrogate details about Huntington's, right? So like, for example, they can ask you which of the following would most likely be observed on brain imaging in this patient, right? You want to pick the answer that talks about like caudate atrophy, right? And you're actually going to have dilation of the frontal horns of the lateral ventricles. That's a very high yield thing to know. Dilation of the frontal horns of the lateral ventricles. Dilation of the frontal horns of the lateral ventricles, right? So what's the deal with Huntington's disease? Remember, it's a transnuclear repeat disorder. Here, the problem is in chromosome 4, right? So autosomal dominant. You have these CAG transnuclear repeats, right? And some key things that they love to test with this is that, you know, you're going to have this issue of anticipation, right? So they can even ask you something about, because remember, our friends at the MBMEs, they love prognosis these days on the USMLE exams. So they can ask you about the prognosis of his future offspring. Their prognosis is going to be worse. And they can ask you about the mechanism behind the worsening of the prognosis. You want to talk about, you want to pick an answer choice that talks about an expansion of the trinucleotide repeats, right? So that's the genetic principle of anticipation, right? Basically, as the expansion worsens, the thing that's going to happen to these person's kids is that you're going to have worse disease, you're going to have earlier presentation in successive generations, right? Especially when you get it from your dad, right? Especially with paternal transmission. Just one of these kind of strange things you need to know for your exams, right? So again, what's the pathophase? The pathophase here is that you pretty much have a gain of function mutation, right? In the Huntington gene. And as that happens, you're going to have the death of neurons in the caudate and in the putamen. So it's not only the caudate that is messed up. Again, our friends at the MBMEs know, hey, caudate atrophy. Make sure you know these other strange things I'm talking about, like loss of neurons in the putamen. That's pretty high yield to know for your exams. Or, you know, almost like a hydrocephalus ex vacuo that we see with the frontal horns of the lateral ventricles, right? So again, remember, they're going to have choriform movements. They're going to have all these psychiatric problems. They can have like, they can make a Huntington's question like a depression question, right? A psychosis question and things like that, right? And then they're going to have like progressive dementia. Keep that at the back of your mind for your exams. And we're going to manage it typically with a tetrabenazine. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a child, right? You have this, you know, this child is coming for his 3-month appointment. You may be told that the mom had proper prenatal care, delivered the child at home, and this is her first physician visit, her first pediatrician visit. And you're told that the child has like this long, narrow face, very large outward facing ears, so these large everted ears, right? And then you're told that you can hear a holosystolic murmur at the fifth intercostal space in the left midclavicular line. Well, if you see something like this, I'd really hope you're saying that, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like Fragile X syndrome, right? Fragile X syndrome. Remember, it's a trinucleotide repeat disorder as well. It's a CGG, trinucleotide repeat. It's X-linked dominant, right? It's X-linked dominant. That's pretty high yield to know for your exams. And the genetic mutation is in the FMR1 gene, right? But basically, what's the pathophase behind Fragile X syndrome? Well, the thing that happens is you actually don't have a structural protein defect, right? You actually do not have a structural protein defect. The thing that happens is when you have this trinucleotide repeat issue, you're going to have hypermethylation and silencing of your genes. Remember, one of the ways we silence our genome is by methylation, right? So you pretty much have hypermethylation, you silence your genes. When that happens, then you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be in trouble. And this is one thing that they like you to know with regards to epidemiology, right? So the thing is, this is actually the second most common genetic cause of intellectual disability. It is the second most common genetic cause of intellectual disability in kids, but it is the most common heritable cause, right? So you may be wondering, Divine, what is the most common genetic cause of intellectual disability? It's going to be Down syndrome. Down syndrome is number one. But remember, Down syndrome is not heritable. It's not heritable. It's a genetic problem, but it's not heritable. But Fragile X syndrome is a genetic problem, and it is heritable. So Fragile X syndrome is number two in terms of genetic causes of intellectual disability after Down syndrome, but it's number one in terms of genetic syndromes causing intellectual disability that are heritable. Okay, this is a classic error that many people make on the exams. So sorry, let me just kind of say something, just an offshoot point, and then I'll come back, I promise, to Fragile X syndrome. For example, let's talk about brain cancer, right, in kids. The most common primary brain tumor in kids is a pilocytic astrocytoma, right? Number two is a medulloblastoma. But medulloblastoma is number one in terms of malignant primary brain tumors in kids, because medulloblastomas can spread. They can spread through CSF pathways from the brain to the spinal cord, right? So just kind of keep that in mind. All right. Now, classic things you're going to see with a fragile X syndrome, right? You're going to see a long, narrow face, right? Large outward facing ears. Sometimes you may see them use the term everted ears, right? And many times these kids will have, especially after they hit puberty, they're going to have macroorchidism. They're going to have very big testicles. So the thing is, those big testicles, you may not see those early in life, but as they hit puberty, you're going to start seeing those big testicles, right? And then that murmur I described is the murmur of mitral valve prolapse, right? Very, very common in kids that have, fragile X syndrome, right? And remember, you can also see this whole genetic anticipation problem, right? Especially when you get the mutant X chromosome from mommy, okay? So remember what I said about Huntington's. I said that Huntington's genetic anticipation tends to be more pronounced when you get the defective gene from your dad. But for fragile X syndrome, the problem tends to be more pronounced in terms of anticipation when you get the bad gene from your mom. That's pretty high yield to know for your exams, right? So mom for fragile X, dad for Huntington's. Mom for fragile X, dad for Huntington's, okay? That's really high yield to know for purposes of your exams. And then remember, people that have a fragile X can also have a lot of GERD, right? That's actually one of the most common GI disorders in those folks. And then what if they give you a question about a child, right? And they tell you, actually, like, you know, they give you a question about a person that has a Marfan syndrome, right? And then they ask about what is the most likely cause of mortality in this patient, right? What is the most common likely cause of mortality in this patient? I'd really hope that you're going to pick an answer that talks about like aortic, something related to the aorta, right? The thing is, Marfan's is something that is probably in every Anki deck known to mankind, right? Probably in every Anki deck known to mankind. But the thing is, for purposes of the USMLE exams, they really do expect you to know a lot of surrogate things about Marfan syndrome, right? So remember, you know, the heart problems are the things that basically kill these people, right? You know, they have like dilation of the aortic root. They can have aortic dissection, right? They can have mitral valve prolapse, right? Remember, what's the other disorder we've talked about so far that has MVP? It's going to be what? Fragile X syndrome. It's going to be fragile X syndrome, right? In fact, because of all these heart problems that these people with Marfan's can get, we tend to get echocardiograms on these people fairly frequently, right? Fairly frequently. So I don't know that for your test. So what's the pathophase behind Marfan syndrome? Well, remember, it's going to be a fibrillin 1 mutation, right? It's going to be an FBN1 mutation, chromosome 15, right? It's autosomal dominant, right? So the thing is, when you have this defect in fibrillin 1, elastic fibers are not going to form very well. You're not going to form good elastic fibers, right? And then you're going to have increased TGF-beta signaling, Again, the USMLEs, they know that you know most of what you need to know about Marfan's, right? So again, they start going after these offshoot points, right? So again, they can give you a question about Marfan's. You're reading the question. You know that this is a definite Marfan's question. And then the right answer ends up being increased TGF-beta signaling. Or the right answer ends up being impaired elastic fiber formation, right? The thing is, many questions on the USMLEs these days don't have direct answers. The answers that they promulgate are answer choices that describe things instead of give you direct things. Like, oh, like you read the question, you see the answer that says Marfan's. No, those things are becoming rarer and rarer on the USMLE exams. Now, remember, what are some classic findings in these folks, right? You're going to have like very tall stature. They're going to have arachnodactyly, right? You know, with their digits. They're going to have pectus deformities, right? So they can actually give you a restrictive lung disease question in a person that has a Marfan syndrome, right? Because the thing is, when they have those pectus deformities, one thing that can happen is that it can actually make your chest wall, you know, they can have chest wall problems that makes it hard for the lungs to expand, right? And if the lungs cannot expand, you're going to have a restrictive picture of lung disease. So typically that's going to be associated with a normal DLCO, right? And a normal AA gradient, because their lungs don't have any problems. It's just the area around the lungs cannot seem to expand very well. So that's why they have restrictive disease. Right? And again, remember, for people that have Marfan's, again, don't forget the heart problems, right? The mitral valve prolapse, the aortic root dilation, the aortic dissection, right? And remember, these people will typically have an upward lens dislocation, right? So it's going to be superotemporal, right? Superotemporal, right? Contrast this with a person that has a downward dislocation of the lens, which we find in a homocystinuria, right? Again, that up and out in Marfan's versus down and in a homocystinuria. Again, they may use, again, unusual terms, right? Like for like Marfan's, they can say superotemporal, right? So just kind of keep that in mind. You see the term superotemporal, think of a Marfan's syndrome. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a child that has, you know, they tell you that his joints are very mobile, right? And that this child, you know, his parents have restricted him from playing because he tends to get very significant injuries that are very difficult to heal whenever he plays with his friends outside, right? And they tell you that, oh, that this child has very, on physical exam, the child has like soft, velvety skin. If you see something like this, what are you thinking about? Well, I'd really hope you're thinking about Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, right? So remember, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, there's two types, right? There's the vascular type, and then there's the classical type, right? So what's the pathophase? And these are both autosomal dominant. You got to know that for your exams. So what's the pathophase here? Well, the pathophase here for the vascular type is that you have a type 3 collagen problem, right? So the mutation is going to be in a COL3A1, right? When you have that vascular type, you're going to have like very fragile arteries, you're going to have very fragile organs, right? So the thing is, these people actually have a super high risk of like rupture of arteries, right? Or they can have like bowel rupture, they can have like uterine rupture, right? So like, for example, if a person has Ehlers-Danlos, it's probably not a bad idea for those people to do a scheduled C-section instead of going into labor. You don't want those people to go into labor because the uterus can literally explode, right? That's not a good thing, right? Or if you see like severe sudden onset abdominal pain in a person that has a history of Ehlers-Danlos, and then they tell you about free air under the diaphragm, right? Or the person has like signs of peritonitis and, you know, bowel rigidity and things like that. Then you probably want to think about the person having some kind of bowel rupture, right? So they can have like arterial rupture, right? That's what can cause them to have like aortic dissection. They have like arterial rupture, they have aortic rupture. So kind of keep that in mind. And then the classical type is a COL5A1 mutation. So guys, be careful, right? So COL3A1 is the vascular type. That's a type 3 collagen issue, COL3A1. The classical type is COL5A1, right? That's the one that gives you like the hyperextensible skin, the joint hypermobility, the easy bruising and things like that, right? And the thing is, again, they may try to stay away from the word hyperextensible skin on your exams. Instead, they may tell you that the person has very soft skin, very velvety skin. If you see something like that, you really want to think about a person having Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, right? So the thing is, these people, they have wounds that are very difficult to heal, right? And many times when he heals, you're going to have like these, almost like sometimes on exams, they may describe it as a cigarette paper scar, right? So one thing I just want to mention here before I move to the next disorder is, please do not conflate Ehlers-Danlos syndrome with Marfan's. This is a common error people make on the exams, right? Many people think that Marfan's is a collagen problem. No, Marfan's is not a collagen problem, right? Marfan's is more of a fibrillin. It's a connective tissue scaffolding problem. Right? Ehlers-Danlos, on the other hand, is an actual bona fide collagen problem, All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, right? And you're told that this patient, you know, is brought to the, he's a 4-year-old boy. He's brought to the emergency room by his parents because he has been clutching his left lower extremity for the last, 4 hours. And then you're told that, oh, that they do a skeletal survey and they determine that, oh, this child does have a fracture. And then they tell you that this child has had multiple similar presentations in the past as well for, you know, fractures. And then they will try to throw you a smokescreen answer to kind of mess you up about picking something with calling CPS or whatever, Child Protective Services. But the thing is, in addition to that, they will give you some stuff in the question that talks about like the person having like blue sclerae or whatever, right? Whenever you see something like, and then they can tell you that the child seems oblivious when he's called by the physician or whatever. Whenever you see some, and you know, they can even tell you something about like dental imperfections on a physical exam. Whenever you see something like this, think of osteogenesis imperfecta, right? If you notice for this podcast, I'm trying to hit on the important high yield things, but I'm also trying to emphasize some of the unusual things that you may not see mentioned in many resources, but it's kind of high yield to know for your exams, right? So let's talk, because this is another collagen issue, right? So osteogenesis imperfecta. So remember, it's a COL1A1 mutation or a COL1A2 mutation, so autosomal dominant, right? So remember, we talked about Ehlers-Danlos vascular kind, that's COL3A1. That's the vascular type. Classical type, COL5A1. Okay, now look at this. Osteogenesis imperfecta, COL1A1, right? It's a type 1 collagen problem. Unlike Ehlers-Danlos, that's a type 3 and type 5 collagen problem. So COL1A1 here, or COL1A2, right? So the problem here is that type 1 collagen is not made properly, right? So you literally have defective type 1 collagen synthesis, right? And the thing is, basically, most of these kids, it's more like just a quantitative reduction in how much type 1 collagen they're making, right? Most, it's not that they have like no type 1 collagen at all. If you have no type 1 collagen at all, that's really bad, right? So most times they will have type 1 collagen. They're just not making enough of it. So you're going to see like a lot of fractures, minimal trauma, right? And they will try to get you thinking about child abuse, but it's not child abuse, right? So just be careful about that, right? Now, because remember, type 1 collagen is found in bones, right? So you're going to have a lot of fractures with minimal trauma, right? And then remember, blue sclera with this stuff, right? So, and what's the mechanism behind the blue sclera? Because again, they can say which of the following most likely explains the ocular finding in this patient. Again, the USMLEs these days, they're very big on pathophysiology. Remember, the blue sclera is because the person's sclera is very thin, right? It's very thin, right? To make your sclera, you do need type 1 collagen for that, right? But if you don't have enough type 1 collagen, your sclera is going to be very thin. So the stuff that's underneath the sclera that normally you should not be able to see, you end up seeing, right? That very thin sclera is going to make it very easy to see the underlying choroid. So it's enhanced visibility of the underlying choroid layer that is the mechanism behind the blue sclera in a person that has osteogenesis imperfecta, right? And remember, these people that have OI, right, they can have hearing loss, right? So keep that in mind, because remember, your middle ear ossicles are literally bones, your malleus, your incus, and your stapes, right? And remember, they can also have issues with their teeth, right? They can tell you some story on your exams about dental imperfections. If you see this, think about osteogenesis imperfecta. Think about osteogenesis imperfecta. In fact, sometimes on exams, they call this a dentinogenesis imperfecta, dentinogenesis imperfecta, right? And then just real quick, a closely related disorder, I'll talk about this, and then I'll wrap up this podcast. I think I'll probably do a part two of this. I think this stuff is kind of high yield for the exams, right? Again, you know you're going to see these things tested, especially on the multi-systems processes and disorders, because, you know, it's just a disparate series of things, right? But achondroplasia is the thing you don't want to mess up with osteogenesis imperfecta, right? Achondroplasia is also autosomal dominant, just like OI, right? And it arises from an FGFR3 mutation, right? So the thing is here, you have a gain of function mutation, right? So FGFR3 is constitutively activated. It is what? Constitutively activated. And when that happens, your chondrocytes are going to be proliferating like crazy. Your chondrocytes, right? Your cartilage forming cells are going to be proliferating like crazy. So the thing that's going to happen here is this child is going to have like very short limbs, right? But you'll have a normal size trunk, right? In fact, sometimes on exams, you may see this term rhizomelic dwarfism, rhizomelic, R-H-I-Z-O-M-E-L-I-C, rhizomelic dwarfism, right? And you'll have like, macrocephaly, they'll have frontal bossing and things like that, right? So macrocephaly, frontal bossing, right? And the thing is, most cases that we see here are spontaneous mutation, right? As spontaneous mutations. And because our friends at the MBMEs, they like risk factors on the exams, they can ask you about the most likely risk factor. Think of increasing paternal age, right? So increasing paternal age is a high yield risk factor for this stuff. Unlike Down syndrome, where it's increasing maternal age, that is a big time risk factor, right? And remember, these people that have achondroplasia, they're going to have normal intelligence. They're going to have a completely normal lifespan, right? It's not a lethal skeletal dysplasia. They're going to have a completely normal age, completely normal lifespan, completely normal intelligence. Also, kind of Marfan syndrome also, they also have completely normal intelligence. People that have Marfans, they do not have reduced intelligence. They don't have intellectual disability like we find in people that have homocystinuria, for example. And remember, homocystinuria is autosomal recessive, unlike Marfans that is autosomal dominant. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, if you like the way I teach, you like the way I make integrations, you're going to absolutely love my classes. They start in the third week of this month, right? I made a separate podcast where I describe those, the 2.5 hour test taking strategies class, 4 hour biostatistics class, 1 hour CCS cases class, 5 hour social sciences, quality improvement, healthcare systems, hospital medicine class. And then I have a 3 hour last minute review for step two and step three, and a 20 hour pretty comprehensive review for step two and step three. So if you're interested in any of these classes, just shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. I also offer one-on-one tutoring, and I help with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, and things like that. And then I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I also have a YouTube channel you can check out where I post the videos that I make. And then I also have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Many of you know I'm a Christ follower. So every week I post like one podcast where from a biblical perspective, I do address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, episode 662 to continue this series, but have a wonderful day. God bless you, and bye for now. Thank you.